Thank you very much, Richard. Our next speaker is, as you know, Peter Thiel. Peter is the Chairman and Chief Executive Officer of Confinity Incorporated. Peter's also been a research fellow here at the Independent Institute. He's the past president of Thiel Capital International. He's also worked as a derivatives trader at Credit Suisse Financial Products. He's been a securities lawyer for Sullivan and Cromwell. He's been a speechwriter for William Bennett, a law clerk for Judge Larry Edmondson of the U.S. Court of Appeals. Peter graduated Phi Beta Kappa from Stanford University, and he received his law degree from Stanford Law School. He's a co-author with David Sachs of an Institute book called The Diversity Myth, Multiculturalism and Political Intolerance on Campus. It's a book on the issue of privacy and civil liberties in higher education. And his articles have appeared in the Wall Street Journal, Washington Times, San Francisco Chronicle, and many other places. And for those of you who are interested, he's also rated a national master in the U.S. Chess Federation. We're pleased to introduce Peter Thiel.
Well, David, thank you very much for that long introduction. I don't know if I gave you permission to go through my whole resume, but I guess you're not the government, so that's okay. Well, I want to thank the Independent Institute for putting this event on and giving us an opportunity to step back a little bit and think about some of the bigger kinds of questions that we deal with. You know, we often have these focuses on the immediate kinds of questions. If you look at the headlines in the news on a given day, people will not be spending a lot of time talking about digital money, and you always have sort of the urgent things displacing the truly important things. And I think this is one of the things that's quite big, quite important, and there are a lot of interesting questions it raises about the nature of money, about the nature of capitalism, politics, and the world. And so I want to step back a little bit today and look at some of these questions, talk a little bit about some of the technology that will be used to implement some of the changes we're talking about, and try to keep these things fairly brief and let you guys gentlemen and women ask some questions at the end of the presentation. Money is one of those things that's very, I guess, it's something you see every day, but the more you reflect about it, the more mysterious it becomes. Your typical dollar bill, as Richard pointed out, has no intrinsic value, and yet it is something that people value extremely highly. And so there's sort of this weird kind of subterfuge that goes on when people think about money. It's something that's used, it has value, it's valued by everybody, you can use it to buy things in an economy, and yet it's something that has no intrinsic value. And the kinds of contexts where one can really see this sort of stuff break down are cases where money is sort of in a twilight zone, where it's breaking down. And there have been, of course, countless episodes in the 20th century in the emerging world where governments have gone out of control and have just started printing money like crazy, and the institution has started to collapse, and the link between money and value has really eroded. I'll give you the classic examples are ones like Argentina in the late 1980s, where you had hyperinflation. They had to raise prices in stores three times a day. The government was printing that much money. And so the upshot that was that when people got their paychecks, they had to physically run to their bank accounts and physically run through a grocery store to make their purchases and try to pass the money on to someone else. It was like this game of musical chairs. And the chairs were taken off away pretty fast, so you had to keep running really, really fast. The government of Idi Amin in the 1970s ran out of money, so they asked the Treasury Secretary. The Treasury Secretary came to the dictator in Uganda and said, "We have no money left. You've spent it all." And said, "Well, just print more." And again, these are sort of extreme examples, and yet they're not totally inappropriate in any other context. I think perhaps the worst hyperinflation in the 20th century took place not in the Weimar Republic in Germany, not in Hungary, in the Twin Wars era, in any Latin American country. It took place in Yugoslavia, or Serbia in particular, in the 1990s, where in the course of the last 10 years, they've inflated the currency by 23 orders of magnitude, which means that one dinar in 1989 can buy about as much as 10 to the 23rd dinars would today. Now, periodically, they just lopped off a few zeros, and then it would reinflate, and they lop off a few more zeros. And so Richard talked about the government basically stealing everything in Russia three times in the last 12 years. Well, if you think that every time one order of magnitude, it's like 90% theft. They've stolen everything in the country 23 full times. And the remarkable thing is that they've gotten away with it. They've been able to sort of blame everybody else except for the government for 10 years. They've been quite effective in generating a series of scapegoats to divert people's attention. I think sort of another example is Mobutu Zaire. In the late 1990s, they periodically flew in these jumbo jets from France where they had the printing presses. They didn't have anything, nothing worked in Zaire anymore, not even the printing presses. So they had to fly in the jumbo jets with the physical currency. And by the time the government was coming to an end, it had gone up to a million Zaire note. I don't remember exactly what the currency was called. And basically, people in Kinshasa and the capital were no longer accepting it as legal tender. Because they were accepting 100,000 notes, but million, this just seemed like too much. And so they actually had rent some more jets and fly it to some local provincial capitals where people were a little bit more behind the times and were still willing to accept these million denomination notes. Now, these are sort of the extreme examples. When we talk about, when we talk even about countries like the U.S., Western Europe, and so on, there has been a significant erosion of monetary value. And the single currency in the world that has been the most robust currency in the last half century is the Deutsche Mark in Germany. And even so, one Deutschmark today has only about 20% of the purchasing power of one from 50 years ago, around 1950. So it would only buy you as much as 20 Pfennigs would have in 1950. With respect to U.S. dollars, it's about 10 cents on the dollar over the last... It's been inflated by about a factor of 10. And with respect to British pound sterling, you're down to about a factor of 20, and so on down the line. So it's the sort of stuff that happens on geological time. It's something people don't generally notice. And yet the musical chairs are slowly pulled away. And the fundamental problem, when we think about it, comes back to this initial paradox I started with, which is that money has intrinsically not very much value. And the nexus, the place where you have value in a capitalist society, is in intellectual labor, in real property, in the relationships that exist between people as they work together in corporations and as individuals, in the kinds of trading relationships you have. And to the extent money is closely linked to that, it has real value. To the extent the link gets broken more and more, it has less and less value. And one of the questions is, and the sort of a fundamental philosophical question is, who gets to control that link between the medium of exchange and the goods that are exchanged? And to the extent it's controlled by governments, you can have governments that where it erodes in small ways, like in Germany or the United States, or in very big ways, like in Zaire or Serbia in the 1990s. And to the extent it's controlled by individuals, it's likely that you can have a currency which is linked to real value and therefore does not erode at all. And what I want to sketch out is sort of the optimistic, futuristic scenario in terms of how we might be able to move from the world today of massive government and massive fiat money into a world in the early to mid-21st century where this will no longer be the case at all and where it will be very, very different. I think one of the basic paradigm for thinking about this is as a reverse Grisham's law. Grisham's law is a law in economics which says that good money gets displaced by bad money over time. It comes from the Middle Ages when the sovereign was able to coin gold coins, and then every now and then he collected some taxes and melted them down and coined coins with less gold content in them and had more coins to spend. And then people in the rest of the economy gradually take the ones with the high gold content out. And so gradually, the currency got worse and worse and worse. A reverse Grisham's law would work something like the following. It will be something where you have a choice between different currencies. And the choice is not left to the sovereign, but to the individual. And in a sense, the individual becomes sovereign and is able to make choices regarding which currency they want to take. And when the individual makes these choices, they will choose better currencies rather than weaker currencies. And there's sort of a two-step process that I think this will go through. The first step is one in which we will go from really bad currencies, like, let's say, the currency, the Serbian dinar or the Russian ruble, to currencies where the link is not quite as troubled, like, let's say, the U.S. dollar. And then the second step is where we will get rid of currency in the fiat conventional sense altogether, and it will be replaced by some kind of asset classes on real assets. And I want to sort of suggest to you that this process is already quite a bit further along than people think on both scores. The first one, going from rubles to dollars, or from Zambian kwachas to dollars, or Brazilian real to dollars. The fact of the matter is that in many ways, given the global telecommunications network, given the interconnected world we live in, it is increasingly possible for people to substitute their currency for others. Richard mentioned the statistic that 70% of the U.S. physical currency is now held outside of the country. One of the remarkable numbers is in the case of Russia. It's estimated something like $40 billion in physical cash is held in Russia. Only about $180 billion is held in the United States. The Russian economy is about one-tenth the size of the U.S. economy, so that, in effect, a greater percentage of the Russian GDP today is held in physical U.S. dollars than of the U.S. GDP. And the same thing is true in a lot of these other emerging market countries. In China, the number is something like $30 billion U.S. dollars. India, it's $20 billion. Argentina, Mexico, 10 to 15. And what's basically happened in these countries is you have periodic currency crises in which the currencies collapse, and you have banking systems that are controlled by very corrupt political elites, and every few years the banks collapse. And in Russia, they actually managed to do both at the same time last summer, where not only did the currency become worthless, but for good measure, there was none left. So you went to a bank and there was no currency left either. They managed to pull it was unusual. Normally you do one or you only have to do one or the other, but sort of they just for good measure, they reduced both the currency and the quantity to zero at the same time. And so you have people holding physical dollars. And this dollarization trend is a very, very powerful trend. It's in Russia, it's in a lot of these countries, it's now basically legal for people to have dollars. And it's in other countries, it's still very illegal, but it's basically just being done by everybody. There are, of course, massive problems with holding dollars. The big ones are, again, some of the ones Richard identified in terms of theft. It's dirty. It's not very fungible, and so on down the line. And one of the questions is, how do you move from these physical dollars to electronic dollars? I think the basic technology is going to take place on the internet. I think the specific platform in the emerging world is going to be on a cell phone platform. If you look at the numbers, there are about 360 million, about 150 million online desktop-based accounts today. That number is projected to grow to about 300, 350 million in the next 5 years. However, with respect to cell phones, internet-enabled cell phones are just getting rolled out right now. They already have some significant penetration in Japan, in Finland, in Sweden. They're getting rolled out in Western Europe, the U.S. next year. The numbers are projected to grow from about 10 million internet-enabled cell phones today to about 1 billion in 5 years. In 5 years from now, everybody who is a member of the middle class in the emerging world and in the developed world will have an internet-enabled cell phone. And this sort of a cell in China, the numbers are projected to go to something like 300 million cell phones, most of which will be internet-enabled. These people will have access to their bank accounts, and it will be very easy for them to move money into an account in a safe jurisdiction where the banks are not politically controlled, and they will basically be able to completely dollarize the economy. There will be no need to have any rubles or renminbi, and it will be non-traceable. No matter how illegal the Chinese communist government says it is to hold U.S. dollars, you will have a password on your cell phone, and the only way to stop this process would be literally to shut down the telecommunications network. And that's the kind of choice governments like China, India, some of these other countries are going to face. They will either have to shut down the telecommunications network and make it illegal for you to own a cell phone, or they will have to basically give up the kind of monetary sovereignty they've had and the enormous power that they've been able to wield as a result of this kind of sovereignty over the last many, many years. I think this process is already full-fledged. The dollarization worldwide is going to be accelerated enormously by the technology. Now, the second theme is a little bit more speculative, and that is that that getting rid of money altogether, going from digital dollars, from any kind of government-backed currency, to purely private currencies. And what a private currency, or what private money, I think, fundamentally means is that there is no medium of exchange. You exchange value for value rather than exchanging value for something the government says has value for value. And whenever you have this intermediate step of the government saying something has value, that's where you have the subterfuge, the sort of legere domain come in the game of musical chairs, where every now and then a chair gets pulled out, and it turns out that you're the one holding a dollar bill that's all of a sudden become worth a little bit less. And the kind of exchange of value for value, you know, the classic model would have been some sort of a barter model. That obviously has enormous transaction costs associated with it. These transaction costs go down in a digital age. And the kind of model that I think is the most likely to take place is one where you have other kinds of financial instruments that are very, very liquid. The one I would cite in the U.S. would be something like an index on the S&P 500 or some sort of generalized stock market index, where instead of having currency as being the place where you have value, it is in real property, real companies, things that actually have real value. And so that you might conduct business by trading, not dollars, but trading little slivers of the S&P 500 or of particular large stocks like Microsoft or something like that. My guess is that it might be the whole stock market as a whole, and that as you trade these things, that's where you have the kind, that becomes, in effect, a de facto currency. Now, this is still pretty far-fetched, but it is not quite as far-fetched as you might think. And just as we've had people in Russia replace rubles with dollars, we have had people in the U.S. replace dollars with equity. And over the last 20 years, one of the very big sort of financial debates that takes place is whether the U.S. equity market is wildly overvalued or whether it's at a fair value or undervalued or anything like that. And one of the things people often talk about in making judgments about whether the equity market is overvalued is something called the risk premium on stocks. What is the expected return on equity over government bonds? And for much of the 20th century, the risk premium has been enormous. It's been something like 7-8% in the 1930s, 1940s, and even a decade ago, it was still 4-5%. You expected to earn 4-5% more on equity than on bonds, and that's why they were priced. Today, the risk premium on equity has gone down to about 2%. And so people are saying they're not much more risky than government bonds. Now, if we really carry this digital argument to its conclusion, there will come a day at which the risk premium might be zero. If you actually look at the volatility in price, it's about the same. There's a strong theoretical reason for suggesting the risk premium should be zero, and maybe it should even be negative. Maybe at the end of the day, companies like Microsoft and McDonald's and Intel and the whole conglomeration of companies has more intrinsic value than any given government, even the U.S. government. So that if you believe that that sort of trend is going to take place, we are already starting to see this kind of displacement. And again, it's always a question of whether you want to impute this particular explanation to it. But I think it is one interpretation of what's been happening with the equity markets is they're basically starting to function as currency. And of course, this is the way people talk about stocks all the time, is that it's driven by liquidity, it's driven by people putting money into stocks, all of these things, because that's what people perceive the true value to really reside. There are some, you know, questions in terms of what can go wrong with a scenario. I agree with Richard on an awful lot of things. One place where I will disagree is not a big fundamental disagreement, but it's a disagreement on emphasis, is I don't think the big fights on this are going to be fought in Washington, D.C. I think that, actually, it's for all the reasons Richard cited. The people in D.C. are completely backwards. They don't understand any of the technology, and even to the extent they can, it can't be stopped. You cannot stop things on the level of Washington, D.C. in terms of shutting down these encryption protocols, things like that. I think that government actors who are intelligent and who understand what's happening have realized on some implicit level that the only way they're going to stop this kind of digital revolution is to hang together. They must hang together lest they all hang separately for exactly the same reason that otherwise you'll have money going to offshore jurisdictions where there's low taxes, privacy rights, things like that that are enforced. And the classic example I cite in this regard, and I think there's a very powerful push in this, is the whole formation of the Euro trading zone in Europe in the last year. Perhaps the single biggest push for it was this realization that jurisdictional competition was inexorably pushing things in the direction of free markets. Western Europe today, the 15 governments in Western Europe, I believe that 14 of them are effectively run by social democratic governments. It is the most left-wing configuration in the history of Western Europe in terms of the politicians who run it. They're not interested in a common currency because it helps business or it facilitates trade, even though those are the kinds of reasons that initially were used to push it and that were part of what drove it. They're interested in it because they see it as the first step towards political union, and they see political union as a precondition for preserving the welfare state and the massive governmental apparatus as it today exists in Western Europe. The euphemism that a lot of the politicians like to use in Western Europe is something called tax normalization. And what that means is that there should be no unfair tax competition, which arises whenever one jurisdiction chooses to use lower taxes than another jurisdiction. And in a context of Western Europe where the jurisdictions are relatively small, and it's possible for people to move to lower jurisdictions, such as the UK or Ireland, which are relatively lower than France and Germany and Italy, you want to harmonize these taxes and basically prevent this. And of course, Western Europe itself is not a logical stopping point. Sort of the one thing that's gone wrong with their plan is that the globalization has gone even faster than their political consolidation. So they've been able to consolidate these jurisdictions in Europe into a single large jurisdiction, but at the same time, there are all these offshore jurisdictions that have popped up and so on. And so you have people like LaFontaine, the former finance minister in Germany, who is and the current finance minister in France and a lot of these countries, urging that transactions offshore jurisdictions be shut down, that basically it be made illegal to have offshore tax havens. And again, if you just sort of think about how in the world can this happen or what does this mean, well, what it means is that politically you have to create a de facto global government. You have to basically turn the whole planet into a prison to prevent anyone from escaping. And there are some difficult questions whether it's possible. My sense is that I'm optimistic in a sense that I don't think it's going to happen, but I think it is going to be a real fight. And it's not going to happen under the auspices of the United Nations or anything like that. It probably will happen through various multinational bureaucratic agencies. It will happen through collaboration between U.S., Western Europe, Japan, various governments to basically make it illegal to put money into offshore jurisdictions. They will figure out ways to put very large pressure on these small countries. And there is a question of how, you know, islands in the Caribbean will be able to hold up if you have the U.S. government or Western Europe basically send a fleet of ships down, try to shut them down. Now, there are questions about whether this is going to happen or not, but that is clearly what they are thinking. That is what intelligent socialists realize they need to do today to preserve the government as it is currently constituted. The stupid example of this, and sort of the counterexample, would be something like the government of Malaysia, which 1 year ago decided they want to basically prevent currency trading, and the government of Malaysia said, from now on, the Malaysian ringgit has value only inside of Malaysia. Outside of Malaysia, it's worth zero. Inside of Malaysia, it's worth 3.8 ringgit to the U.S. dollar. Outside, you have to have an infinite number of ringgits to buy a dollar. You can buy ringgits with dollars, but you can't buy dollars with ringgits. And those were the basic rules they set up. And under those rules, they were able to basically create this artificial preserve within Malaysia. Now, that's not going to work 5-10 years from now. With the global telecommunications revolution, the internet access that we're talking about based on cell phones, that kind of a solution will no longer work. I think it is an open question whether the kind of push that's being made by people in Brussels for tax normalization across the world, whether or not that might work. So I have 1 minute to go here. I think I actually may just leave it at that. I think that it is a very exciting future. I think that we are basically going to there are incredible technological forces pushing us in the direction of digital currency, of a world of limited government, limited tax authority and ability. I think there are some very powerful countervailing forces, and we really should not underestimate them. I think the sort of tension that has existed between technology and politics is in some ways likely to perhaps become even more exacerbated in the early 21st century. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Peter.